You're listening to a podcast from Blogging Heads TV.
Hi, Nagar.
Hi, Bob.
How are you doing?
Good. How are you?
I'm doing fine. Let me introduce this. I'm Robert Wright. This is The Wright Show, available on both streaming video and via audio podcast. You are Nagar Mortazavi, a journalist who covers Iranian issues in particular. You have written for a number of places. You're currently at The Independent as a consultant editor, I gather, and you've written a couple of pieces lately for The Independent that are relevant to what we're going to talk about, so we will link to those. You've also written for other places in the past, and you've been a broadcast journalist for a while. You had a show, I think, on Voice of America that covered Iranian issues. Now, what we're going to talk about today and what you've written about, for starters, I mean, we may get into issues about Iran more broadly and Trump's policy toward Iran and the possibility of war with Iran and so on. But you've played a role in uncovering a kind of scandal, I would say. And there's actually a couple of scandals that have been uncovered that are not totally unrelated. The one you've played a role in, it turns out that the U.S. State Department has been paying someone to, among other things, attack critics of Trump's Iran policy on Twitter, and it was not evident to the casual Twitter user that this was someone being paid by the U.S. government to make these attacks on people like you and others. And I would say in some cases, from the tweets I saw, it bordered on questioning their loyalty. And in some cases, they are of Iranian heritage, as you are, which makes it, you know, a particularly dicey kind of charge to even implicitly make, right? To question someone's loyalty to the U.S. A number of these people are Iranian Americans. So let's talk about that. I mean, then there is this second fascinating story that was broken by Murtaza Hussein in the Intercept about. There's a guy who was supposedly named Heshmat Alavi who had written pieces for a number of outlets, The Hill, The Daily Caller, let's see, Forbes, The Federalist, Al Arabiya. Turns out this person doesn't exist, had been writing about Iran. It turns out actually this group that we'll talk about, MEK, which is very pro-regime change, had been authoring these things, and this was a fake person, and all of these supposedly respectable media outlets had been running them. So these are not totally unrelated. Let's start with the first one. What's the story here as you see it, and how did it come to your awareness?
Well, the Iran Disinformation Project, as it is called, and it's been funded by the State Department's Global Engagement Center as a mission state to counter and expose Iranian government propaganda, was funded in late 2018 and started around the same time, at least from their Twitter activity, around December of last year. It seems like they became active. And then within a short while of the start of the program, less than a month in January, they started going off rails and attacking all kinds of people who are not just critics, but in any way seem to be challenging, even questioning President Trump's maximum pressure policy on Iran, the march to war, U.S. sanctions on Iran. There was even a human rights researcher working for Human Rights Watch who was questioning to do research. She was just inquiring about the effect of U.S. sanctions on the shortage of medicine in Iran. She had posted this basically soliciting memo asking Iranians to contact her if they have any information regarding impact of U.S. sanctions on shortage of medicine. And they attacked her. They attacked her, calling her someone who is trying to prove the lies of the Iranian regime officials. And the list was pretty extensive. It included journalists like myself. I'm an Iranian and also an American. Other journalists here in the U.S., it included Jason Rezaian of Washington Post, who was in prison, famously in Iran, for almost 2 years. It also included journalists outside of the U.S. working for diaspora outlets, for example, BBC, Persian, many journalists from BBC Persian. And also, I would say the most bizarre attack was on journalists from Radio Farda, Radio Free Europe, that are outlets that are funded directly by the U.S. government. So U.S. government money was used to attack journalists working for the U.S. government just because they were challenging President Trump's policy, or in some instances, they were covering the stories of the murder of Washington Post journalist Jamal Khashoggi, and they were being attacked for covering it too much, as the implementers of Iran Disinfo deemed. And instead of, being enough pro-Trump and pro-U.S. administration, they were using resources, as they called it, to cover other issues such as Jamal Khashoggi's murder. So I actually found out about this, the fact that this project is funded by the U.S. government a few weeks before. But then I did an extensive search and investigation of the actual attacks, because I knew here and there they attacked me, they attacked a couple other journalists, and we're used to it. This is not the only account. It's not the first one. We've seen even worse attacks. But when I did an extensive research and I found the extent of these attacks and the fact that government money was being used, I decided to just do an expose, and I published on Twitter, I published a list of all of their attacks on Twitter and different people. It included academics at Georgetown University, at Johns Hopkins University, really prominent and credible people, Iran experts, and even civil society organizations who are considered pro-peace, pro-diplomacy, pro-engagement with Iran, and have been opposing war. And it turned into the scandal that we can discuss.
And we should say that in response, the State Department suspended funding of this, what was called the Iran Disinformation Campaign. I guess the Twitter handle was Iran Disinfo. And so for the time being, it's suspended, and they say they're investigating and looking into it. The and a little context on a couple of these things. So as for their aversion to spending too much time on the murder of Khashoggi, of course, the murder was the Saudi regime, which is an arch enemy of Iran and is allied with Trump in his pressure campaign against Iran and so on. The attacking the Human Rights Watch researcher is kind of ironic, because certainly Human Rights Watch has spent a fair amount of time documenting human rights abuses of the Iranian regime. In this case, it so happens that the researcher was looking into the effects of U.S. sanctions on Iranians, which seems to me a fair thing to look into. And I gather from the name that maybe this researcher is of Iranian heritage as well. Is that right? And so when they say you're working hard to prove the regime's claims, you know, which is what they said, or prove the foreign minister's claims in that tweet, when Iran Disinfo says that, again, that carries, you know, a certain kind of implicit allegation of kind of dual loyalty even more heavily than it might otherwise.
Exactly. So Tara Seferifad, the researcher, as you correctly mentioned, she is the Iran researcher of Human Rights Watch, which means the majority of her work, if not almost entirely, is consistent on finding, researching, and exposing human rights violations by the Iranian government. That's what she's been doing. That's what Human Rights Watch's Iran section has been doing. And it turns out that sometimes U.S. sanctions that are actually not included, medicine and food are exempt from U.S. sanctions. But what reports have been shown, numerous reports, is that banking and financial sanctions have had an impact on certain medicine in the Iranian market. And it turned out that she was researching basically the impact, the human impact of U.S. sanctions on basic rights in Iran, the Iranian citizens' rights to have access to medicine or to health. And this Iran Disinfo team could not even tolerate that. And they attacked her once in Persian and then again also in English. And it just seems like from the reports that I had from my sources in Congress, from the briefing they have with State Department, the global engagement team was saying that they had no idea. They accepted that there wasn't proper oversight, at least on the Twitter account, where all this trolling and smearing happened. But this is a serious issue because this is not a once or twice thing. This has been going on almost for 6 months and for the entirety of the duration of this program. And it turns out that this project got $1.5 million as a budget from the State Department. So that's not small money, and it shouldn't really be spent.
Yeah, if anybody wants to pay me $1.5 million to tweet, I am available. I just want to say that's not bad money for tweeting. What's that?
For trolling human rights activists.
Even better. I actually enjoy that. So I would do that for a million because I enjoy that. The Global Engagement Center, apparently, this is the larger project of the State Department, which has a budget of I don't know, somewhere 50, 100 million or something, of which this Iran disinformation thing was a kind of a subset, a sub-project. It is run, I don't know when she took over, but it's run by somebody named Leah Gabriel, who was a Fox News correspondent. And I don't know when she was brought in, or if that coincides with when this thing, as you put it, went off the rails. But I gather the Global Engagement Center started its mission originally, and it goes back to the Obama administration. I think its original mission was to fight online propaganda of terrorist organizations. Slowly it expanded. I think maybe it came under pressure from some non-Trump people to start going after Russia in response to Russia's online. I'm not sure how it happened, but anyway, it's become this all-purpose thing, apparently, where in any kind of information that the State Department wants countered, this they think of this money as being available to counter. Is that your understanding?
So I've spoken to former administration and also State Department officials. For example, one of them spoke to me on the record is Brett Bruen, who used to be at the White House. And the way he explained it was that the Global Engagement Center was created, or the budget was given by Congress towards the end of Obama's administration, after it was revealed that Russia interfered in U.S. presidential elections. And as Brett explained it, it was this chunk of money given by Congress to put pressure on Trump administration to counter Russian interference in some way, and also to counter, as you said, terrorist organization propaganda like ISIS that pose a clear threat, a significant threat to U.S. or U.S. allies, for example, in the Middle East. And Brett's understanding seems to be that the Trump administration did not want to spend much of this money on Russia. They diverted it from Russia into this threat, as they presume, from Iran. And now it seems like they're not just using it on the Iranian government, but also on attacking Iranian-Americans or even non-Iranian-Americans. For example, Barbara Slavin at the Atlantic Council, who seemed to have a moderate or nuanced view towards Iran as far as engagement or diplomacy in a post-war.
Yeah, she's not like some kind of raving lefty. In fact, she was the foreign policy editor, I think, or the foreign reporting editor for the Washington Times for a while, which was a conservative news. I don't mean that she's conservative in particular. It's just that she's not some crazy radical.
What's important is that she's a credible and prominent and trusted voice in Washington. You might disagree with her views, but you can't just go out calling people names without evidence, calling them apologists or mouthpieces. That's just not how this town is supposed to work. And I think that's why the reason for the outcry and the outrage when this was all revealed.
Yeah. Now, do we know who the Iran disinfo campaign is? Who is getting the money? Who is doing the tweeting?
State Department confirmed to congressional staffers at the briefing that the grant was given to a longtime State Department funded organization called the E-Collaborative for Civic Education. Their flagship program is called Tavana, which is what they're known as the brand. And there's an Iranian-American activist, a woman called Maryam Memar Sadeghi, who has been behind the E-Collaborative. That flagship program, Tavana, has been funded by the State Department for years. The funding, I believe, is close to $2 million, as I checked their 2016 tax returns. And also there was one person involved in the project, as State Department confirmed, who works for FDD, the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, And that person is Saeed Qasemi-Nejad, another Iranian here in the U.S. who wrote reports for Iran Disinfo. We still don't know the extent of his involvement, but these were the two people that State Department confirmed.
Was he being paid separately, or was he being paid through this first organization you mentioned, or do we know?
He works, Saeed Qasemi-Nejad works for the Foundation for Defense of Democracy.
Right.
So and he was also being paid by the State Department through Iran Disinfo. But the grant was given to the e-collaborative organization who also runs Tabana and is founded and is run by Maryam Emarsadri, a longtime State Department grantee. And also I found out through my investigation that Iran Disinfo also posted some Arabic tweets. And these two people that State Department confirmed are not Arabic speakers. So my speculation is that there's a third person involved and an Arab speaker. It could be a consultant or it could be somebody involved with the project. And we have a few people who seem very close and in collaboration with Iran Disinfo on Twitter. So we're trying to see who the third person or persons are who have Arabic skills.
Mm-hmm. And of course, the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, which you mentioned, is kind of the anti-Iran think tank in Washington. I mean, they've been very big on putting more pressure on Iran. They were against the Iran nuclear deal, more or less, and they are. I don't know if they're explicitly pro-regime change, but they're certainly a major force in Washington, and they have a pretty clear-cut ideology. Now, and we can link to
this. Just to add, the head of the organization, Mark Dubovitz, has been tweeting, and he's been on the record promoting regime change in Iran. He has opposed the nuclear deal. They're very pro-sanctions, and as you said, it's a very prominent and hawkish organization in Washington that these days has a lot of influence within the administration. That's important because they've always been hawkish on Iran, but under the Obama administration, they were considered more in the fringe. But now the Foundation for Defense of Democracy, some of their former people actually work in the Trump administration, and they have very close connections. Their research gets cited by the administration officials, and it seems like there's close collaboration. So it wasn't a big surprise to a lot of people in this town when it was revealed that one of their employees was also involved with the Iran Disinfo project funded by the State Department.
Yeah, and we can link to a piece in Slate by John Judas that goes into the background of Foundation for Defense of Democracies called The Little Think Tank That Could, I think. And I also wrote a piece in The Intercept just looking carefully at one New York Times article about Iran and how reliant the reporters were on information coming from the Foundation for Defense of Democracies and how that might have slanted and allied groups in Washington, how that might have slanted things. Now, you, one irony here is you have gotten attacks, I guess, of this nature from the Iranian regime and or its proxies, right? I mean, you've kind of gotten it from both sides. Is that right?
Yes, and I continue to do, and I guess that's the nature of being more of a centrist or a moderate voice or even a journalist who covers both sides. The same thing that happened to the Human Rights Watch researcher when you cover Iranian regime abuses, they attack you, and then when you talk about the effects of U.S. sanctions, this side attacks you. But what's, I think, unique about my case is that I work for the U.S. government. I used to work at Voice of America, which is funded by the U.S. government. That's actually what put me on the radar of these different forces, different hardline forces, factions of the Iranian government, specifically the IRGC intelligence. And they started attacking me online. They started trolling me. There were blogs made in my name, fake social media profiles, all kinds of rumors and fabricated lies were spread about me to put psychological pressure. And even my family was harassed and intimidated in Iran because of my work for Voice of America funded by the U.S. government, because they wanted me to stop working at Voice of America on television. And now, just a few years after I leave Voice of America, I worked there until 2013. Just a few years after I leave Voice of America, I turn around and I see that the same U.S. government who put me in a way in that kind of trouble, or my work for them was the reason that I was put in that type of trouble, is now funding this very similar kind of attack on me. I also wanted to add this one little detail that you mentioned, that Iran Disinfo was not properly identified as a U.S. government account. Their website does, somewhere in the bottom, it's buried that they've been funded by the U.S. Department of State, but their Twitter account, which is where they've been trolling people, does not send you to the website, and it does not mention that it's funded by the U.S. Department of State also, which I think is a lack of transparency mm-hmm. that needs to be corrected by the State Department.
And have their attacks on you sometimes been of the character we discussed, where they're kind of between the lines questioning your loyalty? I mean, is that your sense of it?
Yeah, so the people, both Iran Disinfo and also the people who run it, and some of their affiliates that they, when I say affiliates, because they retweet each other. So it's a government account, but it would go ahead and retweet some of their implementers of the project or retweet some of their affiliates. And it's always been along the same lines, calling me either an apologist for the regime or a mouthpiece for a regime, or basically trying to discredit my journalistic work. If I talk about anything that's considered challenging to the administration's policy, or in a way anywhere in line or have commonalities with any Iranian official has been saying, it implies that they've been challenging my loyalty to the U.S. government, basically.
Okay. And before we move on to talk about this other scandal and maybe Iranian matters more broadly, what is the status of this now? I mean, some people in Congress, it's gotten the State Department has suspended it. They're supposedly looking into it. I doubt they're going to find anything they didn't already know, but or at least that somebody in the State Department didn't already know. But in any event, some prominent people in Congress have spoken up about it. Do you have any sense for where this might go? Is Congress going to get involved or anything?
After I exposed the attacks on a Thursday, and immediately the next day on a Friday, State Department announced that this project has gone off rails and that they suspended funding. And to this day, the funding remains suspended until they do an investigation and a process of how things went wrong and how much, what was the extent of them going off rails. From what I understand from the closed door briefing in Congress, the House Foreign Affairs Committee, was that both Democratic and Republican staffers in that briefing, everyone was outraged, and nobody, even the State Department officials in the briefing, nobody approved of these attacks, and everyone agreed that this was definitely unacceptable outside of the scope of the project. And it seems like, at least on the Congress side, there's not much hope for these implementers to be trusted with the money again, because the way the process works is they do the investigation and they can lift the suspension and the return the funds to the grantee. And it seems like at least Congress or most of the people in that briefing were convinced that these implementers would not be should not be trusted with the remainder of the funding, but we still have to see what the State Department says. One source told me that State Department officials suggested they might dump the brand, the Iran Disinfo brand, which has been really embarrassing in the past 2 weeks, but keep the implementers and just give them the money under a new brand, which I believe is unacceptable, because these implementers, at least the names that have been confirmed, have been engaged in these kinds of attacks and smearing and online trolling for years, way before mm-hmm. this program started. So in a way, they were giving money to continue to do what they had already been doing.
Okay. So as for this other scandal, this case where there was more than met the eye, and this guy, Heshmat Alavi, who was writing for Forbes, The Hill, The Daily Caller, The Federalist, Al Arabiya, And I gather actually some of this showed up on VOA's site. I don't know if you read that's right. Okay. So, anyway, he turned out not to exist. He turned out to be a construct of the MEK. Do you want to tell us a little bit? That's a group that at one point was on America's list of terrorist groups. but then suddenly became a friend of, well, it was actually, I think during Hillary Clinton's stay at state that they took them, that they delisted them, took them off the terrorist list for whatever reason, that, you know, and I should say that pro-regime change forces had been lobbying for that because the MEK is very pro-regime change. In any event, I would say this administration is, if anything, more enthusiastic about the MEK than the Obama administration. Do you want to tell us a little about this group? I don't think people know much about it. It's a group of Iranians, and it's in many ways a kind of a strange group, right?
Yeah, so the MEK or the Mujahideen Khalq is a militant organization as so many outlets have reported, basically operates like a cult. And during the bloody war between Iran and Iraq that in the 1980s, they sided with Saddam, the enemy on the other side. And that's one of the main reasons that they have lost almost all support within the Iranian society. They're considered a fringe political opposition as far as support goes. And you don't really see a big population of Iranians following them or really thinking that they're a viable alternative for the current regime. As you said, they're proponents of regime change, and they've had their reports that they've been getting funding and support from some of Iran's rivals in the region, in the Persian Gulf area, and maybe other governments. And also, they seem to have a very strong presence here in Washington. They are, in fact, the only organization registered to be able to lobby related to Iran, because of course the Iranian government can't register, have any legal lobbies and registrations here. They officially lobby, and they spend a lot of money. Some former government officials, former military officials of the United States, former members of Congress have been paid large sums of money by them to participate in their events, to give speeches.
Did John Bolton get some MEK money, or do we know?
John Bolton has definitely appeared in their or in their events, has definitely spoken, and it has been reported by other outlets that he has been given money by the organization. And I guess his most recent appearance, just a couple years ago, 2 or 3 years ago, was when he famously announced that they are a viable alternative for the Iranian regime, and that the Iranian regime will not see its 40th anniversary, and that MEK will be in Tehran by the end of 2019. By year 2019, so by the end of 2019, which is already passed.
Oh, that's a relief.
Yeah, so that didn't happen. And then John Bolton also, I have to clarify, John Bolton, since joining the administration, his appearances with MEK was before joining the Trump administration. And since joining the administration, he has distance himself, or at least publicly, with the MEK. The State Department has on the record mentioned that MEK is not considered a viable alternative for Iran. And the State Department spokespeople have mentioned that the U.S. government is not trying to promote any opposition group, in fact, not just the MEK. But they have specifically said that they're not trying to promote MEK. And now recently, John Bolton, Mike Pompeo, and even President Trump have clearly said that regime change is not official policy of the U.S. government. And I must add this detail, that people who run the Iran Disinfo have publicly been promoting regime change, and even sometimes citing it as the official policy of the U.S. administration, which is now in contrast with what the president has said.
Right. So Trump said that, I guess, a week or two ago, and it was taken. He said, no, the goal is not regime change, basically, something like that. And that was taken as undermining Bolton, who clearly for decades has either been saying explicitly that he wants regime change in Iran, or at least making noises about that. And since then, I didn't realize you said that Bolton himself has now said regime change is not the goal since Trump said that. I didn't realize that. So that the administration now saying it's not the goal, it's clearly is in his heart Bolton's goal. I think Pompeo, before he assumed office, had said things in favor of regime change, but he's not saying them now. And I guess that's so we'll see what
It might be the goal in some people's mind, but it's not the official policy, or at least the official announcement of the U.S. government and the U.S. president. So it's very bizarre that a State Department-funded project will go out publicly, or people who implement it would go out publicly saying regime change is the policy of the U.S. government.
Mm-hmm.
And also, just to go back to the Heshmat Alavi story, there's some intersection. Heshmat Alavi also liked, or the persona, liked to launch smear attacks, online smear attacks. His main presence was on Twitter, on the same type of people that Iran Disinfo has been attacking. Very similar type of attacks, very similar type of people, and in a way also very, very effective. Iran Disinfo had around 1,000 followers when I exposed them last week. Heshmat Alavi had about 30,000. And until the Intercept article came, and the credit to Twitter, at least, for suspending the account immediately after the article came out. And then these other media outlets who took them some while, but then it seems like Forbes has removed his articles. And Voice of America's Persian service had published a dozen of his articles, translated them with his name on their website. And after we reported about that, me and multiple other journalists, we linked to the report. Just yesterday, I believe, Voice of America came out with a statement saying they have deleted them and they are striving to be a reliable source of news, which Heshmat Alavi was.
Okay. Well, that's good. But still, for a while, there was U.S. government involvement in that as well, at least in the sense that VOA was running the work of this.
VOA, and also there was a report by the Washington Post that they questioned a line of policy from the U.S. I believe the U.S. said when Obama struck the nuclear deal, the IRGC military spending increased in Iran. And the Washington Post challenged the White House on the source of that. And they sent a Heshmat Alavi article to the Washington Post as a source for that claim.
Okay. So you mentioned how MEK is viewed in Iran. I'm curious, how is Trump viewed in Iran? I mean, I know there's not any one answer. Iran, like all countries, has different people who view different things. But is there a way to talk about, for example, the effect of the pressure campaign on Iran, on Iranian public opinion? And I mean, I think the goal of the administration is to undermine support for the regime. Some people say, well, it could have the opposite effect because it's like an external attack from seen as an external attack. It could actually benefit the regime. What is your take on how the Trump really high pressure can, and maybe we should quickly review. Okay. So there was this arduously negotiated nuclear deal, with which Iran was complying, that involved, you know, really close monitoring of what Iran was doing on the nuclear front. It was keeping them from, they weren't making anything. It was a civilian. It ensured that basically they had a civilian nuclear energy program. There was no weapons grade material being produced and so on. This had brought to an end a whole round of sanctions that had been used to kind of incentivize Iran to do the deal. Trump backed out of the deal, even though Iran was complying, and imposed as many sanctions as you could impose, started punishing other countries for not respecting sanctions and so on. So it's been a very high-pressure economic campaign, and in fact, we alluded to the fact that Human Rights Watch was starting to document its effect on things like medical care. That's the background, and if I've missed anything or got anything wrong, first of all, correct me, but with that as background, what is your take on how this is being processed?
Well, like you said, there's not one Iran. There's even not one Islamic Republic. There's no Mr. Islamic Republic or Mr. Regime, although there's a supreme leader, but even within the political structure of Iran, you have more moderate voices, centrist voices, you have reformists, and you also have hardliners and hawks. So there are certain elements within Iran, just like there's John Bolton's here, that welcome all kinds of tension with the U.S. to the extent that they even welcome a military conflict. But the top leadership definitely doesn't want a war with the U.S., just like President Trump doesn't want a war.
So neither the supreme leader nor the president, nor the elected president.
Top leadership in both countries are trying to stay away from a military conflict.
Right.
Yeah, that's for sure. And certain powerful elements within both governments are trying to intensify the tension. That's also for sure. But I believe within the Iranian population, it's a little bit difficult to give you any number because political polls in Iran are very, very sensitive. It's a very security, national security issue, and you can't just go around doing polls. Mm-hmm. Of what Iranians think of their supreme leader or what they think of someone like President Trump. But from people who I speak to, and I'm in touch with a lot of Iranians of different backgrounds on the ground, and I also, of course, have friends and family who go back and forth, I wouldn't say President Trump has a lot of support. Now, of course, there are a lot of people who are angry at the regime. There's a lot of economic grievances, social freedoms, political freedoms, people just don't have a lot of hope, young people, for future. There's a lot of unemployment, and people see their own government responsible. Some see the U.S. government, and most people see both governments responsible for this state that they're in, this dire state, mainly of the economy and also of other issues. So some people like President Trump for putting pressure on the regime, as they say it, but most people, I believe, understand how the U.S. sanctions are not really affecting the regime as much as they're affecting the population. The first and foremost victim of the economic pressure, especially on broad sanctions, when you put broad sanctions on the entire economy, on the oil sector, on petrochemicals, on these main sources of income of most Iranians, it is going to first and foremost affect the working classes, the middle classes, and then it will have a less marginal effect on the government. And of course, I must add that there are certain elements within the government who actually benefit from sanctions. So during the years of Obama pre-nuclear deal, when sanctions were really intensified, economic sanctions, because sanctions create an ecosystem that's non-transparent, and the government has to rely on non-state actors to, for example, sell oil in the world market. So you have these people who are acting as government agents, but they're not really state actors. There's no transparency. They have to use their personal accounts. They have to use cover companies, their names. So the ecosystem is just very dark. It's very non-transparent, and that's just the breeding ground for corruption, as I have explained in one of my pieces. And so there are actually people within the Irani, the high echelons of the government or outside the government with connections, that actually welcome more sanctions because they're the ones who get to benefit financially from the black market that's created by sanctions. But the general population is hurt by sanctions, and it's definitely not something they welcome.
And doesn't the Revolutionary Guard in particular sometimes benefit from the corruption that sanctions make more possible?
Definitely. So the Revolutionary Guard is very much involved. It's not a military force alone anymore. They have a lot of involvement in the Iranian economy. They have been some of the strong forces in this shady market that's created by sanctions. And many people, either within the top echelons of Revolutionary Guards or people who are connected to them just outside of their circles, have benefited millions from basically trying to evade U.S. sanctions and personally benefiting from these transactions.
Mm-hmm. Now, is your sense that the amount of economic suffering that's been brought by these sanctions is still a long way from being a kind of existential problem for the regime? I mean, do they have things kind of completely under control for the foreseeable future? Because I'm sure what they're thinking is, well, if Trump doesn't get reelected, then we've just got to hold out, you know, about, you know, 20 some odd months. And what are things like?
Well, for the regime, there's the regime and then there's the population, because they're two separate entities, although they're connected. So for the regime, for the survival of the regime, there's plenty. Iran is a big economy. It's one of the main suppliers of oil, even gas, in the world. And it has a big economy, and the government, the Revolutionary Guards, different portions of the regime are going to survive for a longer time. Sanctions are crushing the economy, but at the same time, we have to remember that Iran survived, this same regime survived 8 years of war with Iraq, with Saddam Hussein, which was devastating on the economy. I lived through some of those years. There were missiles coming down on Iranian cities. It was terrible, but they survived. So as far as survival and existential threat, I don't really see this as an existential threat. If anything, the regime has gotten more powerful, more centralized since the 1980s during the wartime. That was also a post-revolution time, a lot of turmoil, a lot of infighting. They have solidified power. They're stronger militarily. So unless there's a full-on war, like the invasion of Iraq, unless there are boots on the ground and there's a full-on conflict with the U.S. military, which is, of course, the world's most powerful military, I don't see any kind of existential threat to the actual regime. And I don't think a full-on war is anything President Trump or the majority of the population here in the U.S. wants. Because unlike Iran, here it's very easy to conduct polls, and we haven't really seen a support for a full-on war with Iran or any other Middle Eastern country.
Now, Trump doesn't want it. I mean, what worries me is that, well, first of all, that just some weird accident will happen. You know, I'm, you know how these things happen. I mean, you know, Gulf of Tonkin resolution and stuff. And also that maybe Bolton or somebody will convince him that some kind of limited strike could accomplish something, like this will end the nuclear, you know, program forever or something. And then Trump will realize that actually, no, a limited, you know, airstrikes alone will never, if you really want to be sure that you know what they're doing on the ground, in the end, there's no substitute for a ground invasion. Or you can imagine Trump getting sucked in if people keep saying, well, you did, this didn't work, this didn't work. So that worries me a little, but also just the miscalculation issue. And, you know, there were these tankers got attacked. I'm curious what you think about this. So, four tankers, two of them Saudi, were attacked in a way that seemed intended really not to hurt anybody, but to send a message. They were mines, I guess, were attached to them or something. It was a pretty skillfully done thing. It looked like something that was done to send a message. The administration says it's confident that Iran did it, but they haven't shown us the evidence. It seems to me not crazy that Iran could have done it as a way to send a signal to Trump, you know, explaining to him, because I don't think he really understands that Iran has the power to make things very unpleasant for that region if they want, greatly impede the flow of oil and so on. Do you have a take on this? Do you have a theory about what that was? And do you have a concern about that kind of thing spinning out of control?
Well, I don't have any intelligence for sure, so I can't say for sure. Like you're saying, very well, be either Iran or done by some of their proxies. But then at the same time, the Iranians have officially called that laughable. And there's so many theories that justify how this wouldn't be Iran, because it would actually be detrimental to their own benefits and it would be against them. It would provoke the U.S. and everything. But what's clear, until we see the evidence, what's clear is that there are certain forces and there are certain elements who want to see a conflict starting. Now, those elements might be from inside Iran, those elements might be from the U.S., or those elements might be from some of Iran's rivals, U.S. allies in the region. For example, the Israeli prime minister, who's always been opposed to the nuclear deal, is someone who seems adamant in some kind of conflict between the U.S. and Iran. He's promoted attacking Iran's nuclear sites, or implied attacking Iran's nuclear sites in the past. There's also Saudi Arabia and also the United Arab Emirates who've been very much opposed to the negotiations and the deal with Iran. And now, quite frankly, with President Trump bringing up this issue of negotiations again and him saying that he would want to deal with the current leaders, Iran, he doesn't want regime change. I think some of Iran's rivals are feeling threatened in the region, that there might be another deal between Iran and the U.S., which they hated in the past. And so it could, there are so many suspects, I would say. And I don't have access to the evidence, but both sides have pretty strong theories. And like you said, Iran has managed to establish very strong proxies across the region. So although the Iranian military wouldn't be able to confront to win basically against a power like the U.S. military, but their proxies can make life very, very difficult for many U.S. allies in the region if they were to make that decision.
And kind of related to the question of like, well, did Iran do this? Is what, from I think an American point of view, is the kind of unusual structure of the Iranian government. And I think a lot of people don't understand, and I don't think I totally understand it. And maybe you could talk about this a little, because on the one hand, you have the supreme leader whose title is apt. He is the most powerful figure. He is a religious figure by definition. It's a republic of explicitly religious character. And I gather that there's a council of figures who ultimately elect him. But anyway, separate from that, there is a president and who is elected by the people. And the president is not without a power of his own, right? So for example, had Rouhani not won the presidential election before the nuclear deal might well have not happened, right? It took a president, a moderate president who wanted it to happen, for it to happen. So on the one hand, it's not a clear, it's an interesting, and then separate from that, of course, you have the military per se, and then you have the Revolutionary Guard, which I gather is more closely associated with the supreme leader than the military per se, which is more responsive to the elected government. Is that right? You're nodding your head. So I guess all this is true, but do you want to say anything? This will strike some people as an unusual arrangement, I think. Is there anything you want to say by way of illumination?
Well, as you said, the supreme leader is the top leader. He has the final vote on everything. And that's why they had to bring him on board with the nuclear negotiations, and he was finally brought on board. And that's how the nuclear negotiations happened. But the president was the vehicle for that. The president is definitely not without power. He's actually a very powerful figure, any president in the country, but it's not like in the U.S. He's not the top person in power. He doesn't get the final vote. But it's important to also know that the way Iranian, there are elections, but the way the elections are structured is that there's a filtering mechanism. So an outsider of the system can never run, or at least that has been until now.
By the way, that's the way the American system used to, in effect, work, but Trump showed that it, I mean, really, the parties used to have that kind of control. It had to be an establishment figure, but Trump changed that. Anyway, that's just a digression. Go ahead.
So they're not fair and free elections by any definition, but they're very competitive elections. So, for example, President Rouhani, who's considered a moderate within the Iranian political system, was in fact the candidate who was the most distant from the supreme leader. It was an election of a few different candidates, and he was the one with the most distant views from the supreme leader, and he was the one who got the highest votes and very high votes. There's a very high participation in elections in Iran, or close to 7 or 80%. He ran on the mandate of nuclear negotiations and making the deal, and he won the election, and that was the cornerstone of his first term presidency. And then he made the deal with the United States. It was successful. And then for his second term, he basically ran on the mandate that I am the same person who made this deal. So in a way, it was a referendum, or it was the only way of we're talking about polling, of getting a sense of the Iranian population as an approval for the nuclear deal. So you have this president who once ran promising a deal and then once ran promoting a deal he already made, and he won both times. Mm-hmm. And that's a very strong vote. I would say the majority in the population still supports the nuclear deal, or in any way diplomacy or peaceful solutions to the tension with the U.S. I think that not just the Iranian population, but even the political structure, at least most parts of it, are understanding that you can't be at war, or at least a war of words, with the U.S. forever. This is a world superpower, and you have to come to terms. You don't have to be best friends, but I guess it's very similar to the case of Cuba, that at some point there needs to be a detente and a reestablishment of some kind of relations, which was happening under President Obama, but then it stopped under Trump. And now it seems like President Trump also wants to establish that. And that's a very good window of opportunity for Iranians to now this time negotiate with a Republican president, because the Democrats already wanted this established, and now that a Republican wants, there will be even more support, because the Democrats are not going to oppose him basically initiating diplomacy with Iran. So that's the good thing about it.
Although, don't you think Trump would be demanding things that the Iranian regime finds unacceptable? I mean, their positions are, I think, Iran's position is, hey, wait, we're not the ones who got out of the deal. You know, Trump's position when he says, I'm happy to negotiate, what he means is, we're not gonna release sanctions now until you do a bunch of other stuff beyond what you agreed to in the deal in whole other realms, having to do with your deployment of forces, like even in Syria, where the government actually wants the Iranians there, and things like that, and your ballistic missile program, even if it's carrying conventional weapons and so on, right? So I've always assumed that these things are just non-starters from the point of view of the Iranian regime, and so we're not going to get meaningful negotiations with Trump, but maybe I'm wrong.
Well, President Trump hasn't really been consistent as far as what he wants. And just recently and it wasn't for the first time, he repeated that he's willing to negotiate without any conditions, without preconditions. And he basically just said, I just don't want them to have nuclear weapons, which seems to be his only condition, which under the nuclear deal, it was Iran promised to actually never pursue nuclear weapons.
Yeah.
So that's a good starter. Now, the Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, has mentioned 12 conditions, and then he retracted by saying they're willing to negotiate without any preconditions. So I think negotiations can very well start if the Iranians make this decision in the top echelons with the final vote of the Supreme Leader, that it is possible to either directly or indirectly with mediators. The role of mediators are very important at this stage.
And in fact, the Japanese Prime Minister, am I right, is going to do some indirect conversations with both sides.
Exactly. Who has very good relations with President Trump, and the Japanese government has good relations with Iran. If negotiations, and there's no reason why it shouldn't start. In fact, there are certain voices, political voices among the elite in Iran who are pushing for this and saying that you should negotiate. And I think even the Iranian president has understood it, because for a long time, the line of policy coming from Iran, the public line from the president, was that the U.S. needs to get back to the nuclear deal or to the table. I've seen that changing, the rhetoric, because I think the Iranian, at least the president, has understood that there's no way you can bring President Trump back to the deal that was negotiated by Obama. But I saw the Iranian President Rouhani recently saying, lift sanctions, instead of saying, come back to the deal. He was saying, lift sanctions, which would mean the same thing. But without naming the deal as a precondition, basically, for negotiating. And I don't see that as an impossible thing to happen from President Trump. I mean, he's a very unpredictable person. But if he sees that as a condition for getting Iranians to the table, to struck that deal that he's been dreaming of, it's not impossible that he would lift at least major oil or petrochemical sanctions that had an effect on the Iranian economy.
Yeah, I guess my only concern would be that Trump can say all he wants is an Iran without nuclear weapons. That's not hard to arrange, I think. But the fact is, he's surrounded by people, including Pompeo, Bolton, important donors like Sheldon Adelson, who have different views and want more, right? And it seems like Trump has repeatedly kind of, you know, he'll voice these opinions that are at odds with the whole kind of Republican foreign policy establishment and the people he's surrounding him. But in the end, I don't know how often does that. Like he said, he'd get out of Syria. He said, I'm going to withdraw all the troops from Syria. Well, the people around him didn't want it to happen. Didn't happen. And he's no longer saying it's going to happen. So that's the only caution I would throw out.
Yeah, but I also want to remind everyone that Rex Tillerson, before Mike Pompeo, was opposed to leaving the nuclear deal. General McMaster, Jim Mattis, all of these people were around President Trump who were opposed to what he decided to do at that moment. mm-hmm. and they're all gone. So I wouldn't be surprised if Mike Pompeo, if we, one day we hear Mike Pompeo is gone, or if we hear John Bolton is gone, if they don't play the same line as the president, which right now it seems like President Trump is adamant that he has been publicly saying he doesn't want regime change and he wants negotiations with Iran. Mm-hmm. Now, negotiations are different from a deal. Do I think he's capable of striking a deal with the Iranians? I don't think so. We still haven't seen a deal with North Koreans. But as far as negotiations starting, because it's not a fast process, even under Obama, you had 2 years of intense negotiations until you got a deal. So I think what the Iranians want is to at least kickstart the negotiations and use that as a way to lift pressure or reduce pressure, maybe lift some of the sanctions, and then see where the process goes, see how the U.S. election goes. If a Democrat comes, the problem will be resolved because most Democratic candidates have already pledged they're going to get back into the nuclear deal. So there will be none of this this talk anymore. And if President Trump wins again, he goes back to the White House, at least the Iranians will have a clear view of their next 4 years, and then they'll strategize accordingly. But I think what I've heard from certain circles of the political elite, and my understanding and my analysis is that it's good for the Iranians to somehow open the door to negotiations and use that as a way to reduce both economic tensions and also this military posturing in the region, which is very dangerous, like you said.
Okay. Well, good. Well, yours is one of the more hopeful assessments I've heard, and you know more about this than I do. So I'm feeling a little better. Thank you for taking the time, and thank you for exposing that Iran Jacinto thing for the world to see. So people can find your work at The Independent. If they just, I think, Google your name and The Independent, they'll probably find a list of pieces you've written. We will link to these couple of things you've written that are relevant to this particular story. And then what is your Twitter handle?
Yes, so I'm at The Independent, independent.co.uk, and my Twitter handle is just my first and last name, Nigar Mortazavi, because I first broke the story on Twitter, and I actually do a lot of tweeting on Iran. I have a large following, and a good portion of my work is also on Twitter, but also in my articles at The Independent, and also previous places that I've written for.
Okay, and my Twitter handle is Robert Reiter, WRIGH. P-E-R. Thank you so much for taking the time. This is very illuminating, and we will be reading your stuff.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, bye-bye.
Before you go, a quick message from the suits at Blogging Heads TV. Blogging Heads will always be free for you to watch and listen to, and we don't even go the NPR route of guilting you into donating during Pledge Week. But we do have a small request. If you enjoy Blogging Heads programming, rate and review us on iTunes. The iTunes algorithm weighs positive reviews heavily, so taking a few minutes to rate and review us will help more people find out about our shows. Also, of course, we encourage you to subscribe to our Twitter and Facebook feeds. Thank you.